Shall we kick off? Can I just check you can hear me?
Yes, your connection is perfect.
So I'm going to quickly, as usual, just introduce Ukrainian spaces. Sergey has already heard this, and some of you as well, but it's important for you know for everyone else to know why we're here and what we're doing. And essentially what we're doing here is that we see millions of Ukrainians with perfect English sharing their stories across social media platforms. But for some reason, the conversations about Ukraine are still dominated by Western, mostly white and mostly male folks. So not only does it continuously rob Ukrainians of their agency, but it also perpetuates outdated, misleading and false narratives about Ukraine and Ukrainians. So we just want to foster a relaxed, safe and chill space for Ukrainian voices to express themselves without the need of fitting Western boxes. And the rest who are here, the rest of the people who are here and are listening to us, can use this space to educate themselves about Ukraine from the perspective of Ukrainians themselves.
I hope Sergey doesn't mind. I will share one story, quick story that one of our followers shared on Twitter using Ukrainian Spaces hashtag, and it's so beautiful and powerful. I really want you to all to hear it and also share it afterwards. So this is from account with the name Solomia, Solomi Forms, and she writes, being part of the Ukrainian diaspora is a surreal experience. I feel torn apart because of a war in the country of my blood, which is, I have never visited. It doesn't feel like I have a right to feel this way, yet I do. In tears, me apart knowing my Baba and grandmother survived the Holodomor to birth my mother and then me, and within that time frame, another genocide is upon us. The systematic attempts to destroy Ukraine have been horrible and historical, and they live in my bones in ways I cannot describe. And it is, as I said, where my soul is from. I went soul searching when I was younger, Ukrainian-Canadian, who was conditioned to think of her culture as not good enough thanks to colonial values. When I went soul searching, I found Ukraine. I found Lesya Ukrainka, Oksana Zabushko, Oleska Novakivsky, Ivan Trush, a spirit of resistance, of speaking truth, of embracing the melancholy and beauty of the world all at once. Ukraine is the home of me and my values. Yeah, and this moved me so much. Thank you, Solomia, for sharing us this story. And I hope everyone else can also share it, because this is quintessentially Ukrainian, so powerful. And yes, Sergey, hey, our featured Ukrainian.
Hello.
Yes, Sergey Mohov, and he comes back to us again. Because for very simple reason, he is one of our most favorite Ukrainians on social media, on Twitter, and he is one of our favorite truth tellers about Ukraine. That's why the topic that we try to set today is about uncomfortable truths that maybe a lot of foreigners do not want to hear about Ukraine, and said he is the best person to talk about it. Literally, I love every post he does. Can you quickly introduce yourself, what you do, where you come from, and what is your like has been since the genocide started?
Yeah, sure. Well, hi, everyone. Thank you for joining this space. I'm honored to be here. It's the second time, actually. I've been listening before, though, so I'm not entirely new to all of this. It's really cool stuff you guys are doing, by the way. So yeah, I'm Sergey. I'm actually a game designer. I make video games. I have been working as a game designer for, I don't know, something like 12 years now. And yeah, I live in Finland, in Helsinki. And actually, my job is what brought me here. Now, I have never kind of lost, touch with the Ukrainian civil society. I have friends there. I have always gone back home a couple of times a year over the years that I've lived abroad. I basically consider myself, things like, I don't like the word expat, but I don't like it to the extent that it implies that you will come back. That's kind of what I wanted to say, because I guess the common stereotype, and it's actually something that maybe touches on our topic today a little bit, is that you know, the only people that are that can be called expats are, you know, Americans and Western Europeans, and everybody else is an immigrant, right? And the subtle difference between those two terms, besides, you know, the obvious racism, is that immigrants are implied to be people who leave their country, live abroad indefinitely, right? That's kind of the idea, is that you kind of go seeking better life, right? And so on. And you kind of stay. It's sometimes true of anybody. It is also sometimes true of, you know, North Americans and Western Europeans, that they leave their home country and they live abroad. And yet I have very rarely heard anyone call them immigrants. On the other hand, Ukrainians and Africans and, you know, Asians and, you know, like Eastern Europeans in general, not just Ukrainians, I mean, tend to be called immigrants. Anyway, I digress.
it's a space for you to claim, and absolutely for every featured Ukrainian. So you are free to discuss whatever and vent as however you like.
And we're jumping straight into the uncomfortable truths today, so this is perfect.
Yeah, I just started talking about myself, and that's kind of like, and I was like, thought, okay, how should I characterize myself, right? Well, I live and work abroad. Did I ever intend to stay this long abroad or work this long abroad? Not necessarily. I mean, it just kind of depends on where work is and where I like working, right? And it doesn't mean that because I'm Ukrainian, I am here to, you know, come and steal people's jobs and whatever, because that's something that you hear a lot from, you know, especially Western Europeans. But yeah, anyway, so when the full-scale invasion started on February 24th, I was actually planning to spend that day playing Elden Ring, which is a game that was coming out. Being a game designer, it's a pretty influential game, as you can imagine. And instead, I woke up at 5 in the morning, woken up by a phone call from a friend that, hey, a war has started. And I went to a protest, and I met Ukrainians there who were protesting this. I also went to a couple of protests before that, because it was obvious to a lot of Ukrainians that the threat is real. Even before that, but there's only like, you know, 10, 20 people before. And then on that day, February 24th, there were hundreds of people right away. Then I went to a military supply store the next day to, because I thought, hey, what can I do? Maybe I can buy some stuff here in Finland that is available here and send it over to the to our military to help them out. And when I came to the military supply store, I met like 10 more Ukrainians who were there for the same exact reason, that without talking to each other came to the same store on the same day to do the same thing. So we created a WhatsApp group, and I've been basically in communication with these people and their friends and their friends' friends, trying to figure out like, okay, what do we need to buy? Where do we get the money? How do we organize the logistics, where to get a warehouse, how to get permits for purchasing equipment, and so on and so forth. And I've been pretty much nonstop doing that since the invasion started and the genocide and everything.
Actually, I wanted to, because I'm so grateful for you to pick up the topic of Ukrainians living abroad, and because there are 20 million of us, both Ukrainian citizens who are forced to live abroad for various reasons, and also Ukrainians who were, took roots abroad because of many, many waves of repressions of Ukrainians in centuries before. So I wanted to ask you specifically about that experience, because my guess, again, comparing to myself and also Val, that we developed over the years living abroad a bit of higher sensitivity towards all this ignorance about Ukraine that we see and we need and we face abroad so often. This sort of even anti-Eastern European racism, despite that many Eastern Europeans are also white people, but still we face kind of the same racial dynamic as many other people of color in Western Europe. So wasn't it the reason why you are so outspoken about these issues, because it's not like you're just smart. You also, it feels that you're very passionate about what you say, and you have all the right words to describe those experiences.
The fact of the matter is, any person living outside of their country very quickly realizes that whether they like it or not, they become an ambassador of that country. People, especially Ukrainians, I don't know how it's for others, but I guess there is a lot more kind of like intergenerational intermixing between other Europeans because of the European Union, and that has been going on for a very long time. Ukraine has had, you know, visa-free travel to European Union only for past, I don't know, 6-7 years or something. So because of that, as a Ukrainian, I found myself being also the only Ukrainian that most people I've met will ever meet in their life, right, or have ever seen before. So what I say is going to inform those people's opinion and understanding of my home country and everybody in it and its culture pretty much probably for the rest of their life, right? They have no other chance of learning that, right? Because we humans learn through these social experiences, and we trust people that we, you know, speak to face to face. And that's kind of something that was a little bit shocking to me, because when I first moved to the EU, which was in France, actually in 2012, I had thought that it was very much like a normal, you know, that Ukraine was just a normal European country. I had no idea just the level of just sheer ignorance about like where I'm from and who I am and so on that I encountered there. And I've been pretty much nonstop explaining Ukraine to people for the past, now over 10 years, well, almost 10 years, actually. Yeah. So it's something that is that I've gotten good at over the years, I think, because you don't have to do it every day.
You have gotten incredible at it, which is why I wanted to ask you about one of my favorite tweets that you did. I think it was quite recently, where you said that, and I'm going to quote if that's okay, and maybe you can comment on what caused you to express yourself in this way. But you said that maybe the Westerners saying it's the US fighting a proxy war against Russia should ask Ukrainians and consider shutting the fuck up. Not everything is about your academic debates and Reddit politics. We're fighting for our existence. We're grateful for any assistance that we receive. Was this something particularly triggering to you in terms of debates that you were hearing, or sort of what made you, probably name a couple of things that would make me write something like that, but it would be great to hear your motivation for trying to make people pay attention to this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main thing that kind of triggered me to write that thread in general was that I've noticed that people in the West, have these abstract discussions about like, should Ukraine do that or should Ukraine do this, or Russia is that and Russia is this, and they operate on these pretty simplified versions of history that are told through narratives rather than, you know, through actual research. People have different opinions. Some are pro-Ukrainian, some are pro-Russian for some reason. I don't know why Russians actually hate you, just as a reminder to everybody. But anyway, like the whole thing is that when people say, operate with terms like, you know, NATO expansion, they don't even notice what that those terms imply, right? Like, it implies that NATO is an actor in the Eastern Europe that is actively trying to expand. And as a Ukrainian, and if in fact as any, you know, Eastern European country that used to be a part of the Soviet Empire, and every person that lived in those countries knows, NATO is extremely reluctant to accept new members, and especially when it comes to countries that used to be a part of the Soviet Union. Ukraine first tried to join NATO in 2008 and was rejected. And we've been saying that we want to join NATO ever since, pretty much, except, you know, we actually fought a bloody revolution for the sake of, you know, potentially one day maybe joining the EU and NATO. And it is a part of our constitution, in fact, that Ukraine's aspirations are European and Euro-Atlantic, right? So joining the EU and joining NATO. Those are all things that have had overwhelming support in the society since Russia has invaded in 2014. And yet somehow this is positioned as NATO deciding that it wants to expand, right? Like, so on the one hand, it's Russian propaganda, right? Where Russia is justifying its illegal invasion of Ukraine through this narrative of NATO expansion, because NATO has been a boogeyman in Russia, you know, since Soviet Union times, pretty much, and never kind of stopped. On the other hand, it's being perpetuated by people, sometimes well-meaning people, who just use these terms like NATO expansion to the east, right? The fact is, you know, NATO did not expand into Estonia. NATO did not expand into Lithuania. NATO did not expand into Poland. All of these countries joined NATO and had to go through painful and long-lasting and expensive reform of the civil society, of the you know, legislatures, of their armies for years. And it was expensive and it was hard and it was necessary to protect themselves from Russia. And Ukraine is no different.
Absolutely. And it's jarring all the time that folks always, a lot of folks actually in the West always deny a representation for those voices in conversations that are directly linked to this. Like, for example, if you talk about NATO, so-called NATO expansion in the region, why not asking Estonians and Lithuanians and Poles and Ukrainians what they think about this? Do they feel like it is expansion, or is it experience related to something else? And partly I'm super grateful for you speaking out uncomfortable truths, because not only you keep continuously exposing, say, colonial attitudes towards Eastern Europeans and Ukrainians, the lack of agency that is granted us by our a lot of our Western friends, but you also spend equal amount of time exposing Russian colonialism. And this is where we overlap so much, because this is a topic for me very close to home, personal. I also spent a lot of years mainstreaming it. And I wanted to ask you, and I ask it to a lot of people, why do you think that Russian colonialism as an focus, as an issue, it's so easy for us to pin and describe, but it has been in such a hidden plain sight for many decades for everyone else in the West?
Well, a part of it is that a lot of the Western countries that are now democratic that we're talking about here, France, you know, UK, you know, Spain, Germany to a degree, had empires over their history, and they had that colonial mindset not that long ago. During that history, they dealt with other empires in some ways or others, right? They fought against them, they forged alliances with them, they allied with them against other empires, they traded with the empires and so on. Like, the imperial age is really not that long ago. After World War One, the Western countries started to decolonialize, and they started reconsidering their own histories, and they started, you know, talking about the kind of the problems that came with colonialism and imperialism, and they started criticizing that, and they started started giving voices to all of those people whose voices were suppressed for a long time. Russia never did that. The thing is that it's easy to assume as a French person or as an American that you know, if these things happen in your country, that, you know, there's a movement to, you know, to decolonialize, right, to give to grant agency to the peoples that used to be a part of your empire, or that your country has treated unfairly in the past, that Russia, who is also a country in Europe, partially, has done the same, right? And that because they are, they look like you, right? They're white. Putin wears a suit. He doesn't wear a, you know, fur hat. He does ride a horse every now and then, but when you listen to his speeches, well, not the latest unhinged ones, but, you know, over the years, he seems like any other Western politician. And so do the other people of the, you know, Russian government. And, you know, people in the West look at Russia and they're like, well, they're like us, right? Because they look like us. So it must be the same thing. And it absolutely actually isn't. And the history is different. And the way, the attitude toward history is also very different, it turns out.
Right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think a part of the reason is also lack of representation from nations and countries that were colonized. So when we talk about the academic studies and research and also conversations on mainstream media about this region in general, not just Russia, but in region in general, it's always been explained either by West-splained by Western people or by Russians. And the same comes for research in academia, where a lot of departments on your Eastern European or Slavic studies, there are 95%, 99% is all about Russia and Russians explaining Russia in the neighborhood, not us doing that job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, sort of leading on from that, we have spoken about this with Maxim before, and I'm sure this is something, well, I know for a fact you've spoken about this as well, but you know, a lot of Ukrainians, well, first of all, when all of this kicked off and we were all invited, like, to speak or ask for comments or all of this, we were, the first thing that lots of people asked were like, oh, and what do you think about, like, the hate towards Russians that is being spread and all of this stuff? And I remember, like, back then, the sort of approach we had was like, we don't have the energy right now to talk about that. We're focused on talking about Ukraine and Ukrainians and reclaiming our agency in the discourse around, you know, Ukraine and the war. But I think what this has progressed to now is that, you know, there's this sort of, I would say, like, it's more so like in circles of intellectual, I don't know, pseudo-intellectual, I don't even know what to call them, like people who know good Russians. I'm basically going to the topic of good Russians in quotation marks, people who are like anti-Putin, anti all of this. And I was just, you know, a lot of us Ukrainians know that for many, of course, I'm not saying this is like everyone that exists and all Russians in the world, but obviously for a lot of the time, sort of the liberal values of a lot of these people stop when it comes to Ukraine and Ukrainians. They might be, you know, for free speech in Russia and anti-Putin and all of this, but a lot of the time, as soon as like it reaches the topic of Ukraine and Ukrainians, a lot of these good Russians start to crumble. And it's just not a new phenomenon, I guess, in recent history. But you've done some work around that and you've discussed that. What are your sort of thoughts and feelings around what should we tell our friends outside of Ukraine about our feelings on this topic?
Yeah, I think the can you hear me, by the way? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it just looked like it was acting out. Yeah. So one easy way I think to think about it is this. It's not that there aren't any cases of hate of individual in like people and individuals toward other individuals of Russian origins. It is just that these are such minor and actually unimportant in the grand scheme of things cases that are being made a lot out of at the moment that they distract from the real issues that are happening to a lot of people on a large scale from the institution that is the Russian Federation. There's the whole idea of like Russophobia in quotes is distracting and harmful to spreading the Ukrainian cause. Not because it doesn't exist, or rather, not because it doesn't exist at all, but because the level on which it exists, it literally doesn't matter. It is not a problem. It is not a thing that we need to be solving, and it is absolutely not equivalent to genocide, right? So the problem is this, right? And I know that this is not a direct comparison, but it's a similar problem, right? It's not that all lives don't matter. It is that all lives cannot matter until Black lives matter, and that's something that a lot of people in the West understand as a concept. But I don't think that a lot of people understand that saying hashtag not all Russians and trying to fight Russophobia, so to speak, is a kind of problem in the same vein, right? Like it is just like you are distracting the discourse from the actual problems that are actually happening with millions now as refugees, with over a million, I think like 1.5 million now was the official statistic, deported from Ukraine into Russia and put in concentration camps. With 22,000 civilians killed in Mariupol, with children and children's hospitals bombed, with maternity wards of hospitals bombed and people killed in there, with people being starved, with grain being requisitioned from peasants in the southern Ukraine, from agricultural workers in southern Ukraine, right? It is literally World War II and interwar period level cruelty and just disgusting attitude of a lot of people towards a nation that is their neighbor, right? It cannot happen unless there are millions of Russians actively hating all Ukrainians in general. Absolutely. Just for being Ukrainian.
And then a slip with peasants is not coincidental, because this has happened to us before, a genocide of 30s and then man-made famines in 1918 and 1947 by Russians doing exactly the same thing. And it has been happening to us and other nations over and over again. And I think it's not because only Putin, but because Russia has this serious problem with not accepting reality of being colonial power and not atoning for all those genocides and crimes they did over and over again for centuries. And they're so integral to their identity that even conversations about these crimes are extremely uncomfortable, even for the most liberal people.
Yeah.
And we've had these incidents almost daily. The experiences that are very uniquely to Ukrainians, when even the people who are most adamantly anti-Putin, but God forbid you will say something about the collective responsibility of Russian state and Russian people for decades and centuries of genocides and conquests, and then you get all the aggression possible from those people, verbal abuse.
Yeah,
everything. It's so bizarre. It happens all the time, like clockwise.
Yeah, and yeah. It's the same thing with domestic violence, right? It's not that all men are responsible for domestic violence. It's just that shut the fuck up, right? Like it's just literally that. All we're asking, as Ukrainians, is for Russians to stop teaching us how to live, and also let people express their anger and their anguish. And their despair in some cases, and not being moralized. Like it is our tragedy, and it is caused by your country that you haven't reformed, that you haven't, you haven't bothered to question your culture and your history to a large enough degree to stop this, right? So like maybe it's not the time for you to speak up. Maybe it is time for you to actually, you know, keep it quiet and let the victims talk.
And yeah, that's what I think 100%. Is
where are those multi-million protests in Russia? I always like the time if you want to speak up, where is that action? I mean, Belarusians are literally in a guerrilla movement in their own country, sabotaging Russian military supplies, you know, planting bombs on train trainways. And there's nothing like that happening in Russia. All they do is they complain how, you know, hard life is becoming, and that's it. So
yeah, for sure. But the other thing is, like, you know, we were talking about this in one of our earlier podcasts. It's like all of us have a limited amount of time in our day, right? And we have to make really hard decisions about what we talk about right now, what is most important to talk about right now. This might change from today to tomorrow. But I think even with situations like this that we're talking about, you know, for those Russians who are speaking out at least about something, they really need to choose what they talk about. And as Sergei is saying, they really should be choosing to talk about the situation of Ukrainians right now, if they are saying anything, as opposed to, you know, completely changing the conversation and putting it back onto themselves. We've been listening to them, as you said, for centuries now, you know, like it's time for the experiences of other people to be, you know, if not prioritized, but at least heard. I had this thought, and it would be interesting to know what Sergei you have to say about this, but I was going through my own sort of like, how do I respond to, you know, Russian friends and people I know who are not speaking out at all about anything. And to me, I'm kind of like, to me, if you're not actively against it, publicly against it, I don't know if I necessarily endorse your silent behavior, but I don't know. I don't know what others think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it is a moral imperative on everyone, and especially Russians, to say that they don't agree with what is happening, at least, right? That's the least you can do. I also think that it is also absolutely justified on the side of Ukrainians who are, for the most part, living under constant threat of death, right? There's actual rockets falling on our cities and towns every day, thousands of them, like to be angry and to express that anger publicly. And any attempts to silence that anger is tantamount to endorsement of the actions of the Russian government. And any Russians that have experienced that anger when they try to, you know, defend their kind of public stance of like, oh yeah, but what about the Russians? They should know that this is not happening because people necessarily disagree with their position. It's because people are just angry in general, and that's okay. And they should be absolutely okay in the current circumstances. All we want is just to, you know, for Russia to stop killing us, and to be able to talk openly about it in any way that we see fit at the moment. And we'll talk about, you know, reparations or, you know, repairing relationships or anything like that a couple generations from now, probably at this point. This is not the time to do this. We are not going to be friendly with Russians as a whole for a very long time because of what is happening. And that's okay. That's how it's supposed to be right now. I'm sorry. Like, there's just no other way around it.
That's uncomfortable truth for Westerners. They need to hear it. Thank you for that. And I wanted to, you know, also ask you to help a bit a lot of folks that are listening to us, including there are a lot of journalists out there, Western journalists, and part of the reason why they always come here is to be a bit better at covering Ukraine and understanding exactly maybe the reason why it's not okay to put side by side Russian and Ukrainian voices in each report you do, or do this both sidism, like what about Russians and what they say, or equalize our tragedies, and they're not equal by any merit. So if you were, you know, you do it every day on Twitter anyway, but if you would zero in on a couple of things that foreign and specifically Western media get really wrong when they cover Ukraine, and how maybe to do it better, what would you say and what would you pick?
One thing that, and that's not new at all, is a kind of trope that I've seen a lot coming from, in equal measures, Russian propaganda and Putin himself and Western media. And it's to some degree indistinguishable from each other when you actually listen to language used, is the idea of common history between Russia and Ukraine. And just the idea of like, oh yeah, these people are either, you know, to use the Russian term, fraternal peoples, or they share a lot of common history and culture, or any permutation of this statement is harmful at the moment. And in fact, when you actually start looking into the quote-unquote common history of Russia and Ukraine, it is not what you think, right? Ukraine, in its most recent century or two of history, has experienced many genocides by Russia. It has been invaded. It has been cheated out of territories. It has been, its state has been dismantled. Its language has been, it has been forbidden in, like, there's actually a Wikipedia page that shows you all of the restrictions on the Ukrainian language that have been imposed over the centuries. And most of them are by Russia. Ukrainians have been literally enslaved by the Russian Empire, and later also by the Soviet Union. Actually, a little known fact about the Soviet Union is that peasants were not allowed to leave their villages because they did not have passports, and they were supposed to work as slave workers there, basically.
Yeah, my family was like that, and probably yours as well.
Yeah. And then, you know, their crops were requisitioned, and they starved because they couldn't leave, but they also couldn't grow their own food. And that's the kind of history we have in common that we share with Russia. At the same time, this is a neighboring country, right? So you get a lot of people who have, you know, Russian ethnic people in their families, right? Some Ukrainians are married to Russians and have one or even sometimes two parents who are ethnic Russians. The thing is that ethnic composition is one thing, but it is important to understand that Ukraine is not an ethnicity-centered country. It is a political state, much like the United States, in fact. It's a political nation, and that means that people of different blood and, you know, and skin color and different religions are all Ukrainians, actually, right? Like that's the kind of weird thing, is that, you know, Crimean Tatars, who are ethnically a completely different people, right? And in fact, the majority of them are Muslim, are Ukrainians as well, right? By culture, by choice, you know, to a large degree, and that's something that, like, you know, like my dad is actually from Siberia, right? So he's Russian ethnically. My mother is half Russian. I'm Ukrainian though, right? And the thing is that, like, we're not united as Ukrainians. We're not united by blood or by race or by religion. We are united by our culture and by our shared understanding that Ukraine is our home. But that's something that is often misrepresented in Western media also, because in Western media, we often hear the narratives of, you know, Russians and Ukrainians. And the and when talking about that, I often hear confusion when it comes to, you know, language and religion and ethnicity and nationality, and those concepts get mixed up. And that's also, to me, a problem. Because that just represents a fundamental misunderstanding of what Ukraine is and what Russia is and how those things interact with each other.
Yeah, and so one of the most popular myths when folks at abroad think of Russia, they think of a nation state of, you know, Russia means Russian ethnically. When in fact, when you look at the size of that state, no way it's a national state. And you see at the lands, the majority of those lands were conquered, colonized, appropriated. You cannot compare and put on the same level such places and people as Ukrainians and Russians. And I remember clearly we, while our first guest, Oleg Shin, on the first podcast of the series, of the on the first live event, he, you know, compared even the language that is used in Russia describing Russians. There is Rossiyanin, which means a citizen of a Russian Federation, and there is Ruski, which means ethnically Russian. And there is no such thing in Ukraine at all. I mean, whether it is Georgian Ukrainian as me, or Oleg, who is a Korean Ukrainian, or Russian Ukrainians, or any others, we have just one word describing it, our identity, and it's Ukraine, and being Ukrainian. And this, I think, a very powerful example of the time, and I wish people bring that up more often.
Yeah.
Or, which is better, let's never bring up Russia in a conversation about Ukraine. At least I would love to live to that day when it actually happens, and I have an opportunity to explain Ukraine and explain Ukrainianness without mentioning fucking Russia a single time.
Yeah. And Maxim, didn't you say that you like at one point slash still have boycotted attending events about Ukraine that have Russia in the title?
Oh yeah, and it still happens. And actually, wanted to ask Sergey, maybe a tip to everyone else who does events, how to properly identify this problem and also fix it. Because we see a lot of events that are technically devoted to Ukraine, but still keep centering Russia in the name, with the choice of speakers, with the choice of narratives. And sometimes when you actually confirm people about it, and in my cases I had to cancel many times or decline invitations, people get really offended because they were like, well, we're actually just trying to help. I don't understand what is wrong. And maybe Sergey, you have a very good way to explain people how they should spot when the conversation is centered, the conversation about Ukraine is actually centered on Russia, and which is totally inappropriate.
Yeah, I well, like one example I can give is, for instance, the war that is happening right now, right? And what did people tend to call it? I've heard the term Ukraine war in the Western media, and in event names also, in some cases, used quite a lot. And that kind of makes it sound like it's just a war happening in Ukraine. And it's a war happening between Ukraine and whom exactly? I'm sorry, who started this war? Like who are the combatants? Who are the... Like,
who's the problem?
Who's the problem here, right? Like, let's talk about that, right? Let's talk about, like, who invaded, right? And that's why if you actually look up on Wikipedia what this war is actually called, it's called the Russian-Ukrainian War or Russo-Ukrainian War. Because Russia started it and it invaded Ukraine, and it is the aggressor. And using that term, for instance, like when I see the term Ukraine war, I get immediately skeptical about what I'm looking at, because what are you trying to convey here? Is it, are you saying that it's a war that Ukraine is somehow to blame for, or that what are you saying, right?
Invaded ourselves and we're killing ourselves because that's what we do, right?
Oh, yeah. Did you guys see the article that, maybe I shouldn't even talk about it, but the article that made the rounds about how Ukraine and the UK, like Boris Johnson and Zelensky, had an opportunity to negotiate and they didn't, therefore Ukraine is to blame for the invasion of Russia. And I was like, yeah, well, we didn't invade ourselves, did we? It's not like the way to counter that, the way to counter any of this is to just not invade. Like, blame should be put where blame is due and not, you know, some, I don't know, as I said before, pseudo-intellectual pieces of writing that, I don't know, may not detract from the real problem.
It's a classic example of, like, she was wearing a short skirt, so she deserves it, you know? It's like, what are you even talking about? Like, obviously...
Victim blaming 101.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, that's one thing. The other thing is, of course, like giving voices to like actually Ukrainians in events about Ukraine. That should be a no-brainer. But it's like, I mean, you guys have been saying this on this space for a very long time as well, right? That oftentimes you'll get, you know, people interviewing Russian experts on Ukraine. Like, I don't think there is such a thing as a Russian expert on Ukraine. In fact, I don't even think that there's such a thing as a Russian expert on Russia, because none of them, you know, predicted anything that is going on right now. And they were denying it for many years, you know. They don't even know what's going on there.
They were lecturing us, saying, like, we'll stop this hysterics. I remember 100%. months before the invasion, and each and every liberal Russian and subwar friends kept telling me, oh, this is hysterics. You're just hysterical. Stop doing that. Russia will never invade. And I, unfortunately, I still remember it, and I cannot forgive them for that, because that blindness, whether intentional or not, was part of the reason why we're in this genocide as well.
Yeah. And not that I want to mention her name here, but we also, Ksenia Sobchak, the poster child of, I don't know what, Russian liberal values, that posted something along those lines as well, Maxime, basically saying, like, screw the Western media, screw Ukraine, all of these hysterical people saying, you know, Russia's going to invade, calm down, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, terrible, terrible way to...
Fuck them. Yes.
Exactly. But on a good note, Sergei, we need to wrap up because we have 5 minutes left. We know that you do a lot of fundraising for different causes in Ukraine. So we were wondering whether you could tell our audience a little bit about what you fundraise for and how they can support your efforts.
Yeah, of course. So if you follow me, I occasionally post topical fundraisers just by a group of volunteers that I work with directly. So I would encourage you to donate to us because we are very quickly buying things and immediately, you know, giving it over to the troops. You know, if you, of course, trust me enough to give me money, that is, recently we, for instance, fundraised for a couple of generators for our special ops units, and the generators are actually already on the way to us in Poland, and we're going to, you know, I'm actually going to post a picture as soon as we get them. That's on a small scale. There's other volunteers like that also on Twitter. And Twitter is very much a platform for Ukrainian volunteers who are trying to fundraise. And you can find them either through me or other volunteers. And I'm sure Maxim as well, retweeting those fundraisers or just by, you know, looking around yourself. Also, I always, when in doubt, suggest that you should donate to Come Back Alive, which is with the biggest Ukrainian charity that helps the military with non-lethal assistance, and also the Pritula Foundation. These are the two biggest kind of charities with the most resources in Ukraine that are helping the military. And I should stress that you should be helping the military, because I know that it is a constant struggle to get funds for efforts that are not humanitarian in the West, because people in the West think that if they are sponsoring the Ukrainian army, they are prolonging the war. That is not, in fact, true. The war will continue longer. The longer the less prepared the Ukrainian army is, because the Ukrainian army did not start this war, and it is in fact there to stop it. The only way to stop this war is through Russian defeat, and if we want to accelerate that defeat, we need to help the Ukrainian army. Also, you should be donating to humanitarian organizations, so I would recommend splitting your donation 70-30, so you give 70% to a military fund and then 30% to a humanitarian organization, of which there are also many. But either way, I would recommend finding a Ukrainian one specifically, not an international organization that tends to lack in accountability. And they also are not very effective because they have employees in Western Europe and North America who cost a lot of money, with expensive offices and expensive equipment. And they often don't have enough network on the ground to actually help people. So that's what I would recommend. There's some links you can find pretty much anywhere online or on Twitter, or you can even go to my profile and click on the link Support Ukraine Now that I have there.
We won't name any names, but we all know who you're talking about. I also wanted to say that I think I've seen in recent, including ourselves, but also in recent sort of month or so, loads of Ukrainian creators and people who, you know, have been doing a lot of volunteer efforts, including yourself, Sergey, who you know, have been educating the West about a lot of stuff, have started Patreon pages, PayPal accounts, all these various things. There's loads of good communications and narrative work as well that people can sponsor and fund, because, you know, changing narratives and behaviors and attitudes has been really important as well in this war of Russian aggression. So thank you so much, Sergey, for coming again to join us. It was amazing. I loved it again, as per usual.
Yeah, and just following up what Sergey said, as our previous guest, Ivanil Dvinenko, said on our Ukrainian Spaces, if you really want to make your Ukrainian friend super happy, or just cheer them up a bit, just send a receipt about your donation. I think, no matter how small it is, literally, if you will send me something that you donated, I don't know, 2 years or something today, I will be so much happier, and my soul will be healing reading this receipt. So please do that. Donate all the time. This is extremely important. And thank you, Sergey. You're super cool. I hope you get more followers from it. Because you definitely deserve 10 times what you have now, even more. And maybe you will come back and we'll chat more, because I can discuss every your post maybe for an hour or so, each of them.
I also wanted to say that, thank you, by the way, and thank you for inviting me. I just wanted to say that I'm 21 followers away from being designated a mass media in Russia. Which is great, because I might appear on some list of people who are forbidden access to Russia, which is something that every Ukrainian should aspire to. In fact, every person should aspire to, I think.
100%. A badge of honor.
Yes. Okay, folks, Slava Ukraini.
Heroim Slava.
Heroim Slava.
See you next time.